On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Bush moves tonight to a largely domestic agenda in his State of the Union speech, but the state of his presidency is defined more than ever in the latest polls by Iraq. His call for a surge in troop strength has not caught fire. Former Republican chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John Warner, the latest to break ranks in opposition. But the troops are going in. The first additional 3,200 soldiers of the 82nd Airborne have now arrived in Baghdad, and U.S. troops are dying, an astonishing 30 dead over the weekend. Many more Iraqis. New Iraq commander General David Petraeus testifying this morning on the Iraqi crucible. Up next on Point, in advance of the president's speech, a reality check on Iraq. We will hear in this hour from top defense experts and from Baghdad, but joining me first from Washington for a look ahead at the president on Iraq tonight is Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
The president has a lot of domestic policy items on his agenda tonight, sort of any which way, every which way, but Iraq. But of course, he will and has to speak about it. What is expected on the Iraq front from the commander-in-chief tonight?
Well, basically, it's... He doesn't like to use the phrase stay the course, but that's essentially what he's going to be saying. The president, of course, gave the Iraq speech a couple of weeks ago, and it's going to be pretty much the same thing, calling for sending another 21,500 American troops over there. So I don't think he's going to go into fully the detail he went into the last time, but he's going to make the same argument that this war over there, in his mind, is still winnable, just where the final push is needed. And I think he's also going to tie it into the war on terrorism, which, again, is very familiar to a lot of people. This is what he has done from the beginning. So I think you're going to see more of the same, really.
Ken, the response to his surge speech of a couple of weeks ago has been so chilly. The polls indicate around the country, certainly on Capitol Hill, even within a growing number of members of his own party, is there some new rationale, new line of appeal that's clear that he might turn to?
We're not hearing that in the press corps, certainly, and I don't think that's in the cards. You know, the big development in the last few days politically has been that Senator John Warner of Virginia, very, very influential Republican.
Past chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Right, and he has been chairman of the Armed Services Committee now with the Democrats. Of course, they control it, but he is very important in as a building block for the president's foreign policy and national security on Capitol Hill. And he has now offered a resolution condemning the Bush proposal to send more troops to Iraq. There's a number of these resolutions floating around, but the fact that Warner is sponsoring one is a very important sign that the president's losing support with the Republicans. We know, of course, that other Republican senators, Susan Collins, Olympia Snow, Norm Coleman, among them, Chuck Hagel, of course, of Nebraska, have been very critical of the surge, so-called. Now that Warner has turned against it, you know, you have a handful of Republicans, but some very important folks there who have now signaled that this is not going to fly in their minds. So the president has some very serious arguing to do, and it doesn't look like he's having a very good effect right now.
Ken, does it matter? He'll be addressing the full Congress tonight and, of course, the American people. Lots of opposition in both of those forums, but does it matter? Will the president simply go ahead with his surge plans anyway?
I think that's the fundamental question. It looks like he will do that. The way it looks to me is, politically speaking, there's not the votes to cut off money for either the surge or any other way for the Iraq engagement right now. But I think there will be efforts first for non-binding resolutions opposing the surge, then resolutions calling for withdrawal. I don't think they will pass, nor will the funding cuts right away. But it'll probably take a few times, but if things don't get better in Iraq pretty quickly in terms of like the next 2 months or so, then I think the funding cutoffs become very viable possibilities. But I think the president has some room now simply because the way the system is constructed, he's already moving troops over there. The Congress including the Democrats, are not willing to cut the money off right now. So he probably has a couple of months to make this work, and then I think the serious fund-cutting proposals will be coming up, and they may well pass that at that time.
Ken, as you know, General David Petraeus, who's taking over as commander in Iraq, testifying on Capitol Hill this morning. Let's listen to just a little bit of the general's testimony.
Some of the members of this committee have observed that there is no military solution to the problems of Iraq. They are correct. Ultimate success in Iraq will be determined by actions in the Iraqi political and economic arenas on such central issues as governance, the amount of power devolved to the provinces and possibly regions, the distribution of oil revenues, national reconciliation and resolution of sectarian differences, and so on. Success will also depend on improvements in the capacity of Iraq's ministries, in the provision of basic services, in the establishment of the rule of law, and in economic development. It is, however, exceedingly difficult for the Iraqi government to come to grips with the toughest issues it must resolve, while survival is the primary concern of so many in Iraq's capital. For this reason, military action to improve security, while not wholly sufficient to solve Iraq's problems, is certainly necessary, and that is why additional U.S. and Iraqi forces are moving to Baghdad.
Lieutenant General David H. Petraeus, a hero of the early days of the war, now commander in Iraq, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee this morning. Ken, this is an appealing soldier with an appealing history. Could he stave off congressional action with his testimony, with his resolve?
Well, I think in concert with the other factors we've been talking about, particularly that there's not much that Congress can do right now, given the president's authority as commander-in-chief, and given that the war resolution passed 3 years ago, he can move these forces over there now. And Petraeus does have a lot of credibility. He's sort of a calming influence, and as you say, he has a lot of credibility from the early days of the war, and a lot of people wonder why he wasn't given more authority until now, of course. But the question is, I don't think, well, first of all, I don't think that his arguments alone can carry the day, but in concert with these other factors, more or less that the president has already moved these troops, is moving them, I think it gets back to that point that there's a couple of months here of breathing room the president has. But nobody, General Petraeus or the president himself, is going to be able to slow down this train a couple of months from now if things don't improve in Iraq. I think the country is lost patience, and the president has lost a lot of credibility in dealing with Iraq, and I think that there'll be a little breathing room now, but after that, if things aren't better, I think you're going to see things move rather quickly to do something in terms of cutting funding for either a build-up or to start sending congressional directives to the White House and the administration to start pulling out.
Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, I'm sure you'll be watching the president's address, as will we. Thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
We turn now to Iraq. I'm joined from Baghdad by Borzu Dargahi, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Borzu, thanks very much for being with us again.
It's a pleasure.
A terrible weekend for U.S. casualties, 30 between Friday and the end of the weekend, a dozen when the Black Hawk helicopter went down. What are you hearing from U.S. troops, if you've been able to speak with them, about this moment in national policy and changing policy in Iraq and Baghdad, Borzu?
I think it's really hard to generalize about U.S. troops. I know that a lot of U.S. Commanders, and even at the battalion level, are still optimistic. They think that we are winning in Iraq, and they see the small successes in their area of operation as signs of progress. I know that a lot of soldiers in general, on the other hand, enlisted men, are kind of sick to death of it. It's really hard on their families. Some of the soldiers are on their fourth tours here. Some of those guys say it's worth it, but most at this point are just kind of tired of it. Those who go for a year and then come back and see how little has been done and the big scale of things are rather depressed about it.
The surge troops arriving with the 82nd Airborne, what about the Iraqi side of the equation? What's the latest indication of whether or not the Iraqi government can stand up troops to fight with and by these U.S. soldiers as they move more deeply into Baghdad?
I think that the capabilities of the Iraqi soldiers are yet to be determined. The problem is not that they're unskilled or unwilling to do things generally. The problem is that they're more loyal to various sectarian and ethnic chieftains than they are to a national government or the national or to the idea of a national Iraq. And so that creates a lot of problems when they think they're doing the right thing and they're going into a neighborhood and busting heads. But looked at from another perspective, they're engaging in sectarian violence.
Borzu, when the president speaks tonight, is this the kind of thing that Iraqis, that U.S. troops follow? Will eyes and ears be on this speech when as the president speaks to the American people in the State of the Union address?
I don't know about simultaneously, because it's going to be at 5 a.m. Baghdad time. So I think a lot of people will be asleep. But I think, yeah, absolutely. Once people wake up and look on the Arabic language satellite channels, it'll be the first item on the news, and it'll be really important in terms of what the president said. I'm sure it'll be in Stars and Stripes and on the on Fox, and the American soldiers will also watch it during their lunch breaks.
And Borzu in Baghdad, Borzu Dargahi, bureau chief in Baghdad for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
I want to welcome two terrific analysts of what's going on in Iraq and military affairs in general. With us from Washington, Andrew Krepinevich. He's executive director of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, retired lieutenant colonel, 20 years in the Army, famously the author of The Army and Vietnam, served in the Department of Defense under Presidents Reagan, Bush Sr., and Bill Clinton. Andrew Krepinevich in Washington, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Also with me in the studio, Andrew Basevich, professor of history and international relations at Boston University, West Point grad, retired U.S. Army colonel, served in Vietnam, 70 and 71, author of The New American Militarism and American Empire. Andrew Basevich, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
Andrew Krepinevich, first to you. The country's watching, and tonight we'll be listening as the president again, no doubt, puts out his rationale for the surge and the state of affairs in Iraq. When you look at Iraq today, does your assessment of what's going on there line up with what we've heard from the president? We can't stop now. We've got to make another try here. We've got to go in stronger. Does it line up with the requirements of this situation as you assess them?
Well, I think the president's view is that the alternative is so unpalatable. The idea of withdrawal and leaving that region in what could be chaos is so difficult to contemplate. I think he's arguing that this is our last best chance to try and get it right in Iraq. And I think he's going to argue that he needs the troops, and I think there's going to be an implication there that if this is not supported, then we could lapse into a debate over the long term about who lost Iraq and the blame game. So I think he'll probably look to play that card as well.
You know, the argument is put forth that it's really lost already. The crisis has already been created in the years of this war, and the president is pushing troops out to kind of put off the day of reckoning. What do you say to that? Is there room for a last best chance here, or is this already, in effect, a lost cause?
Well, I think the hurdles are high, but what happened when Ambassador Khalilzad went to Iraq back in the summer of 2005 is he negotiated. He actually negotiated with the Americans, with General Casey, about a strategy that became known as the city strategy. Most of Iraq's population is located in cities, and the notion is, the idea is, if you can secure those cities one by one, providing security to the Iraqi people, enabling reconstruction, you can begin to turn this around. But you've got to negotiate with the Iraqi government. They've got to be behind it. And what we saw this past May was, in a sense, a false start at this city strategy in Baghdad with the Operation Together Forward. The Iraqi government didn't pony up what it said it would. It made things actually in many ways more difficult for us. And this, in a sense, right now is the administration saying we learned lessons from that. The Iraqi government is assured us that they'll provide us with the support they say. And Ambassador Khalilzad has worked out an arrangement or what he calls the National Compact among the contending parties that gives this a shot to succeed. And the notion is, it's kind of the New York City principle. If you can, the saying about New York is, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. The argument here is, if you can secure Baghdad, which is by far the largest and most diverse city in Iraq, then why can't you go on to secure Ramadi and Fallujah and Kirkuk and so on? There's a lot of barriers to doing this, but that's the rationale, that's the argument they're making, and I think that's the case the president has got to make more effectively to the American people and their representatives if he wants support for this approach.
Andrew Bacevich, this is exactly the kind of thing we want to reality check. We've been led into many kind of thought constructs about what's going on in Iraq, and then things don't turn out as predicted or advertised. Here's a city strategy, win the city strategy from 2005. Andrew Krepinevich reminds us. Here we are, it's 2007. Is this a realistic strategy?
Well, it's interesting. I received an email just yesterday from an Army lieutenant colonel who had just returned from Baghdad after serving a year there as a battalion commander. And it was striking. What he said was that I already tried to implement the new approach. I studied the lessons of the famous Colonel McMaster campaign in Talifar.
Mm-hmm.
I read the new counterinsurgency manual. I committed
Written by David Petraeus.
I committed my unit to providing security in the district where I was responsible. We did reduce the violence. We did try to bring in the economic reconstruction, and we failed. And his conclusion was that the failure derived from the fact that there really is no legitimate Iraqi government, that at the end of the day, the ethnic groups, the various factions in the population don't believe that the government of Iraq can secure their interests. And so at the end of the day, they're always going to turn to Kurdish leadership, Shia leadership, to protect them. And to the extent that this battalion commander's experience is more broadly applicable, then that says this thing is not likely to succeed.
Andrew Krepinevich, as I read you, it seems that you're saying you wish it would succeed, you'd be willing to give it a try, but it's the lack of support from the American public that may most immediately get in the way of that. Have I got that right? Do you think it could work? And if so, how? Here's Andrew Bacevich saying, you know, email from the front from someone who's tried it. It hasn't worked. The government's hardly become more secure lately. It seems to be getting more rattled, if anything, in Baghdad. If public support were there for this in the United States, do you believe with this relatively modest surge in troops that this could really turn? Could the city strategy work here?
Well, I almost think my good friend Andy Bacevich is a bit of an optimist here. I think there are actually three big barriers, including the American public and the withdrawal of public opinion. One is the Iraqi government. As your correspondent said, and others have said, Dave Petraeus as well, if they're not supportive of this, it's difficult to see how it can succeed. Now, Ambassador Khalilzad has been working on an arrangement where oil is going to be shared, the oil wealth of the country.
Right.
Power is going to be shared. There's going to be a moderation in the de-Ba'athification effort, and it's going to be easier to amend the Constitution again to address some of the Sunni grievances. Can he pull this off? You know, can he convince the Iraqi political leadership that if they don't hang together, they're going to hang alone? Because if the Americans withdraw, they're not going to be in control of their own destiny. It's going to be the predators, the Iranians, the Turks, the other Sunni Arab countries that are going to have more say in the future of Iraq.
What's your assessment? Can he do it?
That's the second problem. The second problem is I think the administration, in some respects, is making things more difficult on itself. For example, Ambassador Khalilzad has been working for over 18 months to stitch this together. What's happening now? We call to the United States. Chester Crocker is going in to be our new ambassador, and as one advisor over there said, well, the bazaar is open again. These leaders will now try and renegotiate with Crocker what Khalilzad was hoping to close the deal on.
And not just Khalilzad, but the whole U.S. team has kind of been withdrawn.
Exactly.
A new squad put in, I think you wrote, as if on the eve of D-Day. So what about it? Is it realistic?
Exactly. The entire senior American leadership over there is being replaced on the eve of what is being advertised as the make or break campaign in this war. I mean, can you imagine during the Battle of the Bulge replacing Patton and Bradley and Eisenhower and Marshall? It makes very little sense. I have a lot of admiration for General Petraeus, but replacing the entire team at the same time is problematic. And also, Tom, you have a situation where there is no unity of command. One of the principles of warfare is somebody's got to be in charge. And in this kind of war, where there's this great interaction between security, reconstruction, intelligence, the diplomatic aspect, the Americans in Baghdad have to negotiate with each other before they can negotiate with the Iraqis. General Casey has not been able to direct the activities of Ambassador Khalilzad, nor has Khalilzad been able to direct the military operation. So you have that that issue. And then finally, quite frankly, you have this issue of whether or not the Iraqis can count on a long-term American commitment. And here the administration has been, in a sense, saying one thing to the American people and something else to the Iraqis. The American people want to hear we're going home. The Iraqis, in a sense, want to hear that we're going to stay, because if we're not staying, then all they are going to do is prepare for the civil war that follows. You know, you look at Iraq in October of 2005, they ratified their constitution. We ratified our constitution in 1789. 72 years later, in 1861, an American as great as Robert E. Lee still felt more loyalty to the state of Virginia than he did to the United States of America. So how long is it going to be, given all the trouble they've had, before a Kurd sees himself as an Iraqi first and a Kurd second, a Shia sees himself as an Iraqi first and a Shia second? You know, this is going to be a long-term endeavor, not maybe at 150,000 troops, but somebody's got to tell the American people, as Secretary Rumsfeld admitted in a memo quite some time ago, this is going to be a long, hard slog. It's going to be long, it's going to be difficult, it's going to be costly. We wish we weren't here. You know, we wish we may have made different decisions, but we are where we are.
Andrew Bacevich, we're looking here for realism, for honesty. Do you see the country supporting a long, hard slog? Do you think it would work even if they do? And what about Andrew Krepinevich says the problem is the alternative is so unpalatable that in the end it's hard to pull out?
Well, I think Andy's putting his finger on what may be the near-term fatal flaw of the strategy. Earlier in the program, Ken Walsh said that Bush has a couple of months to make this work. That's probably an accurate assessment. He's got a couple of months to begin to show that this last effort will, in fact, be delivering some results. But earlier today, I was listening to General Petraeus in his testimony, and Petraeus was, without talking about months or years, was clearly saying, I need lots of time. I need time to deploy. I need time to get my troops oriented. I need time to develop relationship with Iraqis. I need time to provide security. So Bush has 2 months. Petraeus needs many months. Then throw into the mix the fact that we're about to enter the presidential season. I mean, for all practical purposes, the political story is going to shift from governance by Bush to the question, who's coming next? Mm-hmm. So I think that the political clock and the operational clocks are way out of sync, and that's a huge problem.
So American public opinion is a piece of the reality to be dealt with here, but still, for all their opposition to this in the polls and at the ballot box, I think a lot of Americans are listening at some level and saying, but could it work? If we signed up for more time, could it work? Andrew Bacevich.
I really don't think so. I mean, I think we are expecting General Petraeus to do what General Ridgway did back in the winter of 1950-51, an episode that really we've almost totally forgotten.
Talking Korea here?
Korea, the fall of 1950, the Chinese intervene. It's a debacle.
Massively.
U.S. forces falling back south across the 38th parallel. General Walton Walker, the commander of 8th Army, gets killed in a vehicle accident. Ridgway, sent by the Pentagon to take command, and in a remarkable feat of generalship, stabilizes the lines, revitalizes the morale of the U.S. soldiers, and indeed very quickly begins to launch a counteroffensive. Mm-hmm. Brilliant generalship, one guy turning things around. But this is not that kind of war. This is not a war, I think, where firepower, where maneuvering large units, where putting your finger in the chest of your subordinate mm-hmm. and say, you know, we're going to make a stand
push, push. Mm-hmm.
As bright as I believe General Petraeus to be, this is, at the end of the day, a war of lieutenants and sergeants, not of generals. And there, I don't have much expectation that we're going to turn this around.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's take a call from Jim in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi there. How you doing?
Well, what do you see, Jim?
Well, my question was relating to diplomacy versus troop surge. And your guest has answered, seems to have answered you know, my question, saying that there, you know, there is obviously discussion and, you know, trying to figure out how these folks can live peacefully together, which is not a simple question. But my other question, I guess, is the president continues to say we can't leave till we have victory. And it's just every time I hear him say that, I just can't believe. He must have some vision of victory. And what could it be? And he's so concerned about the reputation of us leaving there and not completing the mission because we're going to look like cowards, and that's going to, you know, the terrorists are going to see us as cowards and come after us. And I just think he's just way off track with that. And the surge, the surge to me is another way of saying stay the course. And I just don't like to see young people that are 19, 20 years old dying. I have a son that's 19, and thank God he's not there, because I don't know if I'd want him. I'd probably tell him not to go.
But a lot of Americans are there. Jim, let us pick it up. Andrew Krepinevich, it goes back in a way to your alternatives so unpalatable. Maybe victory is defined as just not entirely, you know, losing our hinder here and having this critical area go up in smoke. Is that what victory is now, just avoiding complete catastrophe?
I think the administration would settle for a lot less than it set out to accomplish. I don't think they're looking for democracy. I think they're looking now for stability. And they may be looking for a lot less. They may be back to the Nixon-era decent interval between the time we depart and the time things that really begin to unravel. But certainly the administration has lowered its expectations. And, of course, the problem here, unlike Vietnam, is it's not necessarily something you can walk away from. I don't think there are necessarily going to be terrorists on the street of Boston the day after we withdraw. But you have to look at the fact that a number of people who live in the region say this opens the way for a larger war between Sunni Muslims and Shia Muslims. This paves the way for Iran to accelerate its nuclear program. All this is occurring in the front yard of Israel. And then you have the whole issue of oil and the stability of the global economy.
I want to turn right now again to Baghdad. We're joined by James Soriano. He's Provincial Reconstruction Team Leader in Al-Anbar Province in Iraq. James Soriano, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom. It's good to be with you.
The president has put a new emphasis on reconstruction. Of course, part of the surge goes to Al-Anbar, 4,000 Marines headed there. Of course, also, when we look back at the history of reconstruction, it is absolutely a checkered one, some successes and an awful lot of failures. What are you focused on now with reconstruction and Al-Anbar province?
Well, Tom, we are the PRT, as you just said, the Provincial Reconstruction Team. We are involved in trying to kickstart the development process out here. We're looking at some infrastructure projects, schools and power generation and that sort of thing.
We're trying to get a kind of sense of what's realistic to expect right now after so many initiatives, James Soriano. Americans have seen projects built and burned, projects both successful and projects corrupt. Iraq hardly looks rebuilt after all these years and all these billions of dollars. How realistic is it right now in the midst of the kind of fighting we've seen in Al-Anbar for reconstruction to effectively take place?
Well, the process really is going to have to depend on Iraqi-led solutions. We're here to the PRT, that is, the reconstruction team. We're here to assist the provincial government, that's sort of like a state government, identify reconstruction projects, begin economic recovery, infrastructure, to help them do fiscal management of these projects.
It sounds good. Is it realistic? Are you sitting in the green zone? Do you believe this kind of reconstruction is or will soon be actually happening in Al-Anbar, given the fighting there?
Tom, I don't sit in the green zone. I live out in Camp Fallujah with the United States Marine Corps out there. I just happened to be in Baghdad for a few days of meetings, and I am...
Got it. Good. We're glad you can do that. Good, good. And what you see, is it giving you heart or not?
Yes, I'm optimistic. I think there are some positive trends in place out in Anbar. You know, they say Anbar is about one-third of the land surface of Iraq, but it has two-thirds of the country's problems. But one problem we don't have out there is the sectarian strife that you see in Baghdad. The enemy out there is a different kind of enemy. It's called Al-Qaeda. And I think Al-Qaeda is on the defensive. There are certain trends that are in place. The tribes in the province are coming together, banding together in an anti-insurgent front. And a recent development over the last 4 or 5 months, I would say, is that the youth of the province are stepping forward to join the police force. We haven't seen that in the past. They're doing so in the hundreds. That is to say, a police recruitment drive is attracting hundreds of applicants. Last summer, I would doubt if you would get more than a dozen people to show up at a police recruitment drive. So there are, when you see that, when the counterinsurgent, if you will, sees that the youth of a certain place is stepping forward to join the security forces, that certainly falls under the heading of positive development.
So there's a note of optimism from James Soriano, who works in Al-Anbar province as team leader for provincial reconstruction team there. James Soriano, good luck to you. Be safe, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. Good to be with you.
Let me take a call from Kelly at Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida. Kelly, you're on the air.
You, Tom?
We're good. What do you know, Kelly?
Well, I was just wondering, it seemed to me, you know, the original goal of Al-Qaeda was to unite the Muslim world against the West as one of their, you know, as they try to reestablish their caliphate and everything.
Yep. So how's it going?
Well, they were doing a really good job, you know, but the thing is, I think they made they gave us an opening here. When they started the sectarian strife by blowing up the mosque in Samarra, they now have the Shia and the Sunni Arab population and Muslim populations ready to go at each other. And I'm just wondering, why are we trying so hard to stop that from happening? If the Muslim world is divided amongst itself, a lot of resources that could be going against the West would be going at each other. So I'm just wondering, why are we trying to keep the Muslim world united against the U.S. and the West when we could be allowing them to turn themselves on each other?
So let them duke it out. Kelly, thanks for your call and your question. Andrew Basevich, what do you say?
Well, I don't take seriously this project of reestablishing the caliphate. It just strikes me that
Al-Qaeda is a putative goal of reuniting the Muslim world under
right. That they don't have anywhere near the capacity, the power to undertake something like that. It does seem to me that you can make a strong argument that rather than surging in Iraq, given the divisions, given what I think is the lack of legitimacy of the Baghdad government, that we'd probably be better off surging in some place like Afghanistan, the forgotten war of the global war on terror, but one that is crucially important and actually might still be winnable. So I guess I share the caller's sort of concern that the strategic priorities of the Bush administration are badly out of whack.
Andrew Krepinevich, what about our Air Force caller's notion? Let's just let the Sunni and Shia battle it out. And in that, he sees possibly something for the U.S., but it's also a road to turmoil.
Well, it certainly is a road to turmoil. Some people argue that if you're thinking about withdrawal, then you do need to think about which side you're going to be on, if in fact we're going to continue to play a role in the region. And one strong argument has been, are we going to support the Iranians, who, of course, are dominated by the Shia sect, and who have obviously penetrated into Iraq, have a semi-satellite in Syria, and dominate Hezbollah and Hamas in Lebanon and in Palestine. And there's an argument that says you need to support the Sunni Arabs, you need to contain and roll back the Iranian influence. And that's certainly a legitimate argument to make. I think another argument is it's sort of the Pottery Barn argument, which is we bear some moral responsibility here. We went into Iraq, we deposed the government, we created a vacuum. And to say, well, that's okay now, let them kill each other and sort things out, I think that's a rather cynical argument to make. Although, quite frankly, one of Muqtada al-Sadr's deputies has said, we want the Americans out. We'll have that war. We're 60% of the population. Mm-hmm. Yes, a couple of million people will die. And if we're comfortable having the blood of a couple of million people on our hands while they sort things out, I suppose, again, that's an option.
It's a heavy question indeed. Tyler's calling from Northampton, Massachusetts. Tyler, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to address the military side of this a little bit. I don't have much expertise on the political and economic side, but as far as I was in the Marine Corps. I served in Anbar and Fallujah and Northern Babel.
Mm-hmm.
With respect to the General Petraeus and his counterinsurgency doctrine, one of the problems that the military is having right now and has had mm-hmm. since the beginning of this. I served in 2004, and the types of actions we were doing then are exactly the same types of actions that we're doing now.
Yep.
They're not aligned with counterinsurgency doctrine in spirit. What
do you mean by that, Tyler? Not aligned with counterinsurgency doctrine in spirit?
Okay. The counterinsurgency doctrine, what it boils down to is, you've heard the term winning hearts and minds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what it comes down to. The center of gravity of an insurgency is the popular support. That's pretty much what every expert on insurgencies agrees.
Sure.
You got to get the popular support. Okay, so if that is true, and this is a military operation, our military operations, our tactical missions, should reflect that effort.
And you don't see that happening. Do you see it happening in the surge? Petraeus is saying, I'm going to move soldiers right into the Baghdad neighborhoods. They'll live cheek by jowl with Iraqi neighbors. Does that help or hurt, Tyler?
Well, again, it comes down to this attitude, and I have way more than to say on it than we have mm-hmm. time for, of course. But it's in the culture of the military. The main efforts are all infantry guys. These are guys who are combatants. That's
yep.
what they're trained to do.
Yep.
That is their nature, their culture. Everything they think about is fighting, killing. And don't forget, there's a lot of frustrations at the very junior, lower tactical level.
Sure.
These multiple deployments.
Lives on the line every day. It hasn't gone well. Yep.
Right. The casualties. So, these guys aren't, concerned. A lot of times they're not concerned about, hey, I hope they work out this economic thing. They're concerned about, when I drive down this road, I get IED'd every time. Now, mm-hmm. if I catch one of these guys IED'ing me, I'm going to be angry. I'm going to be looking for some payback for my friend who was killed yesterday. And it may not be articulated that clearly or that openly, but there's an attitude there.
Yeah, we hear that, Tyler. Let me put it to Andrew Basevich, not in the spirit of counterinsurgency, and who can blame them, but it has a lot to do with whether or not it works.
The point that Tyler is making is extremely important. I mean, from an outsider's point of view, the military, the army, is a hierarchical organization. There's a general in charge, and if General Petraeus takes over and says, we're going to stop doing ABC, we're going to start doing XYZ, an outsider might say, well, then the guys down in the trenches will do what the general says. But the reality is that these huge organizations carry a weight of tradition, of habit, of the way we've always done it. Andy Krepinevich's great Vietnam book makes this point in spades, where the Army went to Vietnam and said, well, we're going to do counterinsurgency.
Mm.
But what the Army did was quite different than that. So a change of commander with a change of doctrine does not necessarily translate into a change in actual operational behavior on the ground.
Let's listen to just a little bit more from that new commander, General David Petraeus, Lieutenant General. Here he is talking with Senator John McCain in his testimony this morning about unity of command between the U.S. and Iraqi forces.
Do you understand the command and control relationships between the American and Iraqi forces in this new plan? I'm very concerned about unity of command.
Sir, I share your concern. Again, on the one hand, though, we have pushed Iraqis to do more, to take charge in many cases. And so we have, in fact, almost a good news, bad news story. The good news is that the Iraqis are willing to take command in many cases. The bad news is that that makes us have to achieve unity of effort rather than unity of command. And that's why we would have to have those relationships all the way up and down with command posts co-located and so forth to assure that.
We need to get that sorted out, General.
Yes, sir.
I know of no successful military operation where you have dual command.
Sounds to me like General Petraeus saying no guarantees to Senator McCain. Let me get a call from Iowa City, Iowa. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I was sort of wondering if it's worthwhile asking ourselves whether or not a different kind of problem solving around the globe is worth considering. If we had gone into Iraq, deposed Saddam Hussein, created the vacuum, and left, would things be right where they are now, or would our prestige be elevated compared to what it is now, and would that have kept the kind of slaughter that's going on now from occurring?
Is there a way to go in fast, do it, and get out? Andy Krepinevich, could you have imagined that? I mean, we don't want to look back too much, but looking forward from with lessons here, is that a lesson you take?
Well, it's hard to play what if, but there's an old saying that power abhors a vacuum. If you go in and eliminate the power that is, which is Saddam Hussein, and leave very quickly, then what you've got is a power vacuum. And the different entities in the region will try and fill that vacuum. For example, the Turkish leader, Erdogan, has said very plainly, there is not going to be a Kurdistan. The Turks and the Kurds would go at it. You'd have the Sunnis and the Shias. You have the Iranians infiltrating there. And at the end of the day, it seems to me you have chaos. And, of course, that's the kind of environment that organizations like al-Qaeda thrive in. So in a sense, I think, as Andy Basevich was alluding to, we have problems in Afghanistan. In a sense, we've created that kind of problem for ourselves, potentially in Iraq as well. So, again, the easy in, easy out may work in places like Haiti, for example, or Rwanda, where the stakes are low, and you're talking about a backwater, but not in this case.
Andrew Basevich, our time is short. We're hearing a lot of skepticism in this hour about the realistic prospects here. So, but something has to be done. What would, in your view, a realistic path forward be here?
Well, Andy Krepinevich has alluded a couple of times to the consequences of failure. I believe that we need to acknowledge that we have failed, and to now focus our attention on containing the consequences of that failure. I do believe that the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group ought to be revisited, that an effort to try to put together some sort of regional diplomatic strategy based on the expectation that nobody actually has an interest in total chaos in Iraq and in the region. I wouldn't tell you that such a diplomatic strategy is guaranteed to succeed, but it seems to me that the chances of success there are far greater than the likelihood that this new strategy with its surge is going to succeed, because it's just not.
Andrew Krepinevich, you've got 30 seconds here. A fight to the finish or begin that pullout and talk to the neighbors?
There seem to be three options. One is a new strongman, a new Saddam, and that could emerge out of an Iraqi civil war with external involvement. Another option is partition. Again, I don't think we do partition. I think the Iraqis will sort that out for themselves at the cost of perhaps millions of lives, and part of that is underway now. And then finally, the outside force to provide stability, whether it's us or the international community, that would be the third option.
We will see if the president is as straightforward this evening as the two of you have been with us in this hour. We're grateful for it. Andrew Krepinevich, Executive Director at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessment, thank you very much for being with us this hour. And Andrew Basevich, Professor of History and International Relations at Boston University, retired U.S. Army Colonel, Vietnam. Andrew Basevich, thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.